when we build financial plans, we tell people that their financial plan is very much like the castle. If you were in medieval times, you put a castle up and you protected your wealth, but also your loved ones in that castle.
Hey there, I am Dr. Jason Ballara, and this is the Know Your Why podcast, where we explore the why behind success. Every week, I meet with real estate investors, veterinary entrepreneurs, mindset coaches, authors, and fitness professionals to uncover their why and how it drives them on the winding road to success. What is your why?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jason Ballara, and this is the Know Your Why podcast. Today, I'm here with Eric Brotman. Eric is the CEO of BFG Financial Advisors and author of the award-winning book, Don't Retire, Graduate. Believes the financial literacy is the key to financial freedom. I agree with that. I'm super excited to have this conversation, Eric. I'm going to stop there on your bio because I want to let you tell your story. But first, I just want to say thanks for coming on the show today. Thanks for taking the time out. I'm excited to chat.
Oh, Jason, thanks for having me. This is going to be a bunch of fun. I think we can definitely tell stories about how we got going.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, yeah. Let's start there. Let's talk about, you know, kind of your background, your foundation, and then we'll take it from there.
I came into the financial planning industry by accident, completely by accident. In fact, in college, I was an English major and was planning to go to law school and do either estates and trust or tax law. I liked math, but I also preferred writing and researching and communicating and those kinds of things. And so I was an English major, and I went to work for a brokerage firm located in Baltimore, Maryland, and it was in the legal department, and was taking my LSATs and working and planning to go to law school, and I just fell in love with the financial world. And what I found was, in the legal department at a brokerage firm, my job was to talk to people, usually either people who were bereaved or people who advised those people who were bereaved, about the next steps operationally that they had to take in order to retitle assets or have beneficiaries receive assets. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many times it was just handled wrong. In other words, I'm sorry for your loss, ma'am, but your husband's ex-wife is still the beneficiary, and therefore that's who's getting the account. Like, literally, that happened all the time. Or I know he had three children, but only one of them is named, and I'm sorry, but that's just the way it is. We can't undo that. And so I saw all of these absolute horror stories that destroyed Thanksgiving for generations of families and said, I think I can do better. I think I can make a difference for folks in that way. And so I actually approached the financial business as a way to sort of look like Holden Caulfield, trying to be the catcher in the rain, protect people from the mistakes that were everywhere. And we still see them everywhere today. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got into the business. It was 31 years ago.
Yeah. Interesting that you mentioned that. I mean, it's... just personal experience, you know, on that bereavement side, my father passed away, and I guess I don't know why people do this, but, you know, he was sick. He had colon cancer. He was sick for several years before he passed away, and still there was nothing in place as far as kind of figuring out what to do, once he was gone. And so, that fell upon me to take care of all that, in his instance, he didn't have a lot. So it wasn't like this, you know, big estate or something like that. But, and then just over a year ago, my grandmother passed away, and I saw, kind of same thing. What happened with my mother and her, my grandmother had seven kids. Like it's just like, there's all this stuff that isn't necessarily handled. And I'm sure that, that's probably not the main focus of your business now, just handling estates, but it's a really interesting starting point to mention, because I think a lot of people have probably some pretty negative experiences around that. I mean, it's obviously a negative, terrible, tragic experience to lose a loved one, but then like having to deal with money associated with that. And it's kind of a, I'm sure that's sort of factored into your thinking going forward.
Well, especially when there's ambiguity or when there's conflict.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know of too many things that can really damage families more than creating, at a moment of bereavement, creating a fight over something. And it might not even be a lot of money. It could be the curio cabinet or the engagement ring,
right,
or it could be a thing. And the fact that stuff breaks up families, to me, is the saddest thing. So, no, that's not the focus of what we do all day. But when we build financial plans, we tell people that their financial plan is very much like the castle. If you were in medieval times, you put a castle up and you protected your wealth, but also your loved ones in that castle. And so, Jason, what was around the castle in every case? A moat. And what is the moat today? Well, today it's not alligators and hot lava and broken glass. Today it's cybersecurity and insurance vehicles and legal documents and other things, but we still need a moat around our castles. And so we start with risk management because it makes no sense to build a portfolio or to build whatever it is, whether it's real estate, whether it's stocks and bonds or funds or other things. It makes no sense to build an enormous amount of wealth and not have it somehow protected. You wouldn't leave your wallet that was filling up with cash sitting on a park bench, at least not on purpose. So why would you do that with your real assets, the big numbers? So we do start with risk management. That does include an estate planning conversation. And sometimes it's not about your stuff. Sometimes it's about the conversation. So sometimes it's, hey, who's going to make decisions for me if I can't? If I have three children and I name one of them to talk to physicians on my behalf if I'm sick, is that because I love that one more? Or is that because that one happens to be a nurse and happens to live locally? You know, and there's conversations that can be had. And so we facilitate conversations between family members and generations, and they don't have to be quantifiable. But qualitatively, who's doing what? Why did we choose this? You know, who's going to take care of grandma who's still living if something happens to me, et cetera, and so forth. And it changes the experience. You know, we've had, unfortunately, we've had about 8 clients in the last year pass away. Older folks, but nonetheless, it's still sad. And, yeah. You know, their affairs were dangerously close to perfect. They were well handled, well orchestrated. We knew the kids. We knew the legal representatives. We knew what had to happen. And, you know, it's much easier to have those conversations when you're prepared rather than going digging through somebody's files in their basement, hoping to find a will or hoping to find a tax return or whatever else you need, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I love the way you put that too. Just, you know, having conversations that aren't even necessarily just around the money. Money's a difficult conversation for people to have in any capacity. And then, I mean, like I invest, we have a real estate investment company. Like these are things that I, appreciate and understand and am an advocate for, but it's still really hard for me and my wife to talk about life insurance policies. And, you know, we had someone talk about the potential for a life insurance policy for our kids. And I was like, I can't even do it. I can't, my kids are very young. I was like, I can't assign a monetary value to my children dying. Like that's something I hope no one ever has to experience, but it's like, there are really difficult conversations to be had.
It's true.
But at the same time, like super important conversations to know, you know, like you said, like who's going to take care of these, you know, X, Y, and Z once you're gone. And so is your focus on that sort of estate planning long-term? Tell us a little bit about kind of, you know, what your main objectives are.
BFG was started, I started the firm in 2003. So I was in my early 30s and I wanted to start something that was a little different than the masses, because there are lots of firms out there. If you Google financial advisors, you're going to come up with a ton. And usually the ones at the top are the ones who spent the most on advertising or SEO or whatever. Most of the firms out there have high minimums. They don't even want to talk to you until you've reached a certain level of financial success, whatever that means. And I wanted to build something that was not like that. I also wanted to build something that was multi-generational. So you ask, well, is our focus estate planning? No, it's not. We certainly do that work, but our focus is multi-generational family financial planning. It is talking to sometimes 3 and 4 generations of a family. It's working with asset transfer. It's working with income, it's working with things like long-term care or other things that could be icebergs, education funding. Is there one generation that wants to help fund college for another generation? And how do we do that? What are the tax benefits to some of the transfers between generations? And how do we do that in a way to keep wealth in the family? And I use the word wealth. I throw that word around. It means something different to everybody. You know, my latest book, Don't Retire, Graduate, which is the same title as the podcast that I hosted for a number of years. I quote the great philosopher, Chris Rock, who at one point said that if Bill Gates woke up tomorrow with Oprah's net worth, he'd want to jump out a window. And I thought that put wealth into perfect capacity. It was total clarity that wealth is relative.
Yeah.
Are you wealthy? Is your neighbor wealthy? Do you look wealthy because you drive a fancy car, but yet you can't rub two nickels together? Or are you the millionaire next door who's wearing, you know, jeans and boots and worth millions of dollars and no one would know?
Yeah.
You know, there's so many different ways. And then wealth isn't just money. It's property, of course, but it's also a wealth of experience or a wealth of knowledge or wisdom or other things that you can impart. So we talk a lot about legacy. We talk a lot about, and you know, you mentioned life insurance for your kids. It's a hard thing. It can also be a very good thing. So my daughter, I bought life insurance for her as soon as she had a social security number, not because I was assigning her a value, and heaven forbid, should I never ever claim on that. Like, I want that to be a gift for 2, 3, 4 generations down the road.
Right.
I did it to preserve her insurability so that if she's not as healthy in her 30s as she was when she was 6 months old, that she'd be able to do that kind of planning on her own. But yeah, there's baggage around that, no doubt.
Yeah. And conceptually, and you know, that's, I understand. Intellectually, yeah, no, that's absolutely makes a total sense. And maybe at some point I will come around to being, but it was just like when that concept came up, it was just, and it, you know, and I think for the listeners, maybe important to understand, I'm assuming we're talking about, there are different types of life insurance, right? So we're talking about, you know, sort of a different product that, as you mentioned, might, you know, sort of go on generationally versus like a term life insurance policy.
There's no reason for kids to have term insurance.
Right.
None. Because you're not trying to plan for their demise, heaven forbid. You're trying to put money in something that'll grow for their lifetime without income tax. So, Jason, there are only 4 places that most Americans can put money where it's never taxed again during your lifetime. And it's got to be used properly. And actually, if your listeners are interested, they can go to lowtaxbook.com. It's a free download and you can read more about them. But there are only 4 strategies. I have been on countless podcasts and done lots of talks. I've only had 2 groups. It used to be 1, but as of last week, there are only 2 groups who've got all 4 of them. Do you feel like being quizzed or do you not want that kind of pressure on your own show?
I mean, I feel like I can only think of 2, but
all right. What are the 2? Let's get the low hanging fruit first. What are the places where most Americans, nothing really esoteric and crazy.
Yeah.
We're not talking about buying, you know, oil fields or racehorses. We're talking about stuff that most people can do where you can put money where used properly. It's never taxed again during your lifetime, at least.
Yeah. I mean, you just mentioned whole life insurance, I think would be
That's one
of them.
That's one.
Health savings account.
Correct.
Is one I know for sure.
Yeah, and probably the best one. That's the one people don't understand. The health savings account is an absolute gift from Congress.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing that people need to learn how to use and use right. But yeah.
Yeah. Now I'm drawing a blank on what the exact term is, but is the education savings 529s?
Yes. I'm giving you full credit, Jason. That was pretty good. 529 college savings plans. There's one more.
A Roth IRA?
Yes. Bingo. Oh,
look at me.
You officially, you crushed the quiz. Now I have to tomorrow tell people 3 people have gotten it right. Maybe it's too easy a quiz. I'll have to throw something else out there. But no, it's true. And if you were to look at my financial plan, there is a significant amount of attention spent on those 4 things.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know there's a tax tsunami coming. It's coming. The government is broke. I don't care what party you're with or what part of the country. I don't care which way you vote. The math is simple. We are overextended. We have an enormous debt. And if we default on that debt, it will potentially eliminate the dollar as the reserve currency of the world. None of that is good. We're eventually going to have to pay the piper. And when we do, it's going to mean much higher taxes on a very small percentage of people, but a very large amount of money. And so if you're in that 1% or you aspire to be in that 1%, you have to prepare for that because it's coming. And again, that's not a political statement. That is just math. The math is that there are not enough workers to support Social Security in the way we're used to it. Medicare is an issue because we're living so much longer than we used to. All of the various math that got done for those kinds of plans were based on us working till 65 and being dead at 72. Yeah. Well, you and I, one of us might celebrate our 103rd birthday. It's conceivable. My money's on you, of course, but nonetheless, it's conceivable. And so how do you plan for that? So having some real tax diversification is something that most folks don't think about. And, you know, I'm not going to say that, you know, you talk about knowing your why. My why is not let's pay less taxes. It's a lovely thing. Don't get me wrong. But that's not the why. That's a what. But it's certainly a good what. If you've got to do something right legally, let's do tax avoidance, not tax evasion. Let's not go to jail. But legal tax avoidance is just smart, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's actually talk about those a little bit. I think that's a, you know, obviously important to people's strategies. And I guess, again, I'm going to do worse on this part of the quiz, but I can understand Roth IRA. I get it. I get that doesn't get taxed on the way out. So you're mm-hmm. putting after tax dollars in and that doesn't get taxed again. Great, great vehicle. I probably have a rudimentary understanding of whole life insurance, but mm-hmm. but knowing that it's not taxed is, I'm not even sure that that might have been the one I would have missed had I not
just
used
went through
context
this,
from right before. Yeah, because I'm not sure I even knew that that was not taxed. The health savings account and the education savings, those are very specific in terms of where they can be used. Correct? Like there's not a way to somehow recover that money outside of health. People are going to have
ways.
Health expenses and things like that. There are. Okay. That's going with that question.
No, I think a lot of people fear putting money in accounts and then getting stuck with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, I am not suggesting that folks who haven't saved enough for their own retirement go out and fund unnecessary 529 vehicles. That's malpractice at best and terrible advice anyway.
Right.
However, if you've already hit the various targets that you need to hit and you can start looking at some of these things as additional, as add-ons, it becomes a very big deal. So health savings accounts, regardless of your income, you can take a tax deduction on the way in. That's a big deal. What most people do is they use them like flexible spending accounts. And an HSA and an FSA are not the same thing. A flexible spending account is use it or lose it. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, you'd put $2,000 in January, and come December, if you didn't have healthcare expenses, you wound up with four pairs of glasses you didn't need, so you didn't lose the money.
Yeah.
It's pre-tax, but it's a lousy deal. I would say that there's also a flexible spending account for dependent care. So if you're a single parent or you're in a two working parent household, you can get up to $5,000 into a dependent care flexible spending account, and you can actually pay for some of the daycare expenses pre-tax. So that's a big deal. That is a layup for anybody who's got a kid in daycare. But the health savings account carries over forever, and it doesn't have to be cash. It can be invested. So a lot of people think an HSA is someplace to store a little bit of money to use, swipe a card for your deductibles and your coinsurance, and it's not. It can be. If you're close to the vest, you do what you got to do. But if you have the wherewithal to save HSA money for the long term, it can grow for the rest of your life. Now, if you're married, you can hold on to that HSA long, long term. If you're not married, what you don't want to do is you don't want to die with an HSA balance, because anyone you leave it to who's not a spouse pays taxes on the full amount the year you die. It's a lousy deal. So you want to make sure you use it. We have a lot of folks who are in their working years who are putting this away, especially married people. And then at 65, we'll start using that HSA for Medicare premiums or for long-term care or for other things, because healthcare costs are going to start to go up. And a lot of times your earned income at that moment is going down as well. So it's great to have that pot of money that you can use. Now you ask, well, what if we don't have any healthcare expenses? If you're that unicorn who never has any healthcare expenses and you want to tap your HSA, you still can. It's treated the same as a traditional IRA once you're of age. So yes, you'll pay taxes on it if you don't use it, but you won't pay penalties on it as long as you're of age for an IRA withdrawal.
Okay.
So it is doable. 529 is a little different.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about college. College plans, unfortunately, they're still governed by states rather than the federal government, which means there's 50 different rules and about 80 different plans. And depending where you live, there's a lot of misconceptions around 529s, because people think, well, I live in Iowa, I have to use the Iowa plan, and then my kid has to go to school in Iowa. And that's simply not true.
Yeah.
In most cases, you can use any of the plans you want, and your kid can go to school anywhere in North America and even beyond in certain cases. And you can use that. The only caveat is that in some states, you can get a tax deduction for your contributions up to a limit if you are in your own state's plan. In other states, you can get a tax deduction against your state income no matter what plan you're in. And in other states, you can't get a tax deduction no matter what you do.
Yeah.
So you have to know the rules where you live, and it is not based on where the beneficiary lives. It's based on where the donor or the contributor lives. So, you know, there's a lot of rules. There's a website, savingforcollege.com, that is incredibly helpful. There's a ton of free information and a ton of stuff out there about which state you're in and how the tax rules work and all that kind of stuff for parents. I think funding in 529 makes a ton of sense. Unless you're a great candidate for financial aid. Because even though 529s don't count against your financial aid in the same way that, for example, a custodial or an UGMA or UTMA account might, it's still assets that at least with a formula are going to be accessible to the school to pay for that, unless grandma and grandpa own it, because they're not on the FAFSA. Every one of these things we're talking about, whether every strat, and you know this being in the real estate business, there are ways to figure out which state you should do the title work in and which state you should have a trust in and how to, it's the same thing with the financial vehicles like this. You have to understand the rules, and these things are booby trapped. I wish they weren't, but they are, and they're complicated. And sometimes that's where it pays to have some professional advice, whether it's legal or tax or financial. Because just getting pointed in the right direction on these things can make a huge difference.
Yeah, I completely agree. And does your firm help with both, like the financial and legal side of things? Is that like, is it kind of rolled into one?
It's not. I'm an accredited estate planner, and I go to conferences held by law schools, but I'm not a lawyer, and no one in this office is a lawyer. So we do not render legal advice. We work with attorneys all over the country, though. We have clients in like 36 states, and so we have to know attorneys all over, and we will work with your legal counsel to make the right decisions. And, you know, we'll defer on the legal document, the drafting, but we'll make sure that we implement the beneficiary changes, the title changes, the deeds, the, you know, how we're going to handle investments moving forward. Do we want them joint? Is there a reason to have them not joint? Should we put a TOD on something and make it payable to a beneficiary, or do we want it to run under the estate for various reasons? What kind of gifting should we do? What kind of philanthropy do we want to do? You're talking about knowing your why. Legacy is more than making your kids rich. In fact, a lot of people specifically don't want to do that. They don't want to ruin their kids. They would much rather create influence and opportunity. And so we're seeing folks fund donor advised funds or charitable trusts or even family foundations where you can put a bunch of money aside and your kids can manage that and run it and give money away. But it's not, you're not making them trust babies. And so the legacy planning of it creates influence and opportunity and the value of a dollar, but it doesn't necessarily mean, oh, I never have to work another day in my life because dad died.
Yeah, no, that's a huge, I guess, thought in my head in terms of with the kids. And, you know, my goal is to teach them as much as I can, not necessarily leave them as much money as I can, or at least leave it in a way that they're almost forced to be smart about it, I guess is the
let's hope.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
Structure it just the right way. I wanted to make sure I ask you this. I don't want to forget. Don't retire, graduate. The title of your book. What is that? Yeah. What is that in reference to?
Well, it's in reference to the fact that retirement is, in its traditional sense, antiquated and maybe a fate worse than death. So no one should do it. Yeah. And I know from the very first paycheck you earn, you're told fund a retirement plan and plan for your retirement. Here's the problem. The problem is the word retire. To retire is, if you look it up, it's to disappear or retreat. It's literally to walk away from something. It's the end of something, but not the beginning of anything. So retirement in its traditional sense was set up, and it's been set up since the 1800s, you know, as a way to get rid of older people and to put them out to pasture. And it's always boggled my mind that in cultures for thousands of years, the elders had the biggest tent. You know, they were the ones you went to with the big problems because they'd seen it before. They were the revered members of the community. And today we put them out to pasture and hope they play at adult daycare. Retirement should not be daytime TV and shuffleboard, and there's not enough golf courses. You have to have a reason. And so you have to have a reason to get out of bed, or you will stop getting out of bed. So it's also longer. you know, Jason, we talked about working till 65 and being dead at 72. Well, what if you want to retire at 58 or 61 or whatever it is? You could live to be 100. What are you going to do for half of your adult life? You're not going to sit around or you will not thrive. So I believe that the retirement has to be completely redefined, not as the absence of work, but as the absence of needing to work. Become financially independent and then find something you love to do every day, whether it's for money or not. It doesn't have to. If you reach financial independence and you don't want to work another day in your life, that's fine. But make sure you have something to do, something that excites you. It might be working at the local food bank. It might be being a tour guide at a national park. But find something to do, whether it's volunteering, whether it's consulting, whether it's teaching or coaching, whether it's part-time. But have a plan. And so, you know, I created something that I sort of called the secrets of the three secrets of the happiest retirees. And one of them is to be debt free. And you know as well as I do, not all debt is bad debt. Debt that is leveraged toward an investment, a la a mortgage or a business debt, isn't necessarily bad debt, but consumer debt is categorically bad. So being adverse debt free. Second thing is to take care of yourself, to have your health. I don't know anybody who's really rich and 80 and really sick and happy. Yeah. It doesn't matter how much money you have. If you haven't taken care of yourself, you're going to be maligned. So I think it's more important to stay. It's so much easier to stay healthy than it is to get healthy. You're not going to die at your desk or work until you're 65 and then say, all right, time to join a gym. I'm going to get fit.
Right.
You sort of do that along the way and you stay healthy. It's so much easier to stay healthy than to get healthy, in the same way that it's easier to stay wealthy than to get wealthy. It just is. You know, it's habits that form that just create self-fulfilling prophecies. And the third thing is a purpose, a sense of purpose to get out of bed every morning. If you're debt-free and you're healthy, you're financially independent, debt-free, healthy, and you have something to excite you every day, you've got a great life. It doesn't have to be for money. But I feel terribly sometimes when I see older people working at jobs that they can't possibly love.
Yeah.
Because they have to. Much better to be financially independent and then find things you love to do, whatever that is. You know, you want to be a tour guide at Gettysburg, be a tour guide at Gettysburg. Whatever, right. You know, your passion is. If you're passionate about history, passionate about economy, passionate about environment, passionate about kids or the elderly or anything you're into. Find something and go for it. And by the way, planning to retire is more than just the money. And you can't just put your 2 weeks notice in and then say, oh, now I got to figure out what I'm going to be when I grow up.
Yeah.
You have to plan for that. You got to figure out what's it going to look like. Maybe you'll take a couple weeks to rearrange the garage when you first retire. But at some point, you're going to have more than just, I'm straightening my LP collection. Like, yeah. You got to do something else to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I love what you said in there about, you know, in reference to health, like you're very unlikely to decide the day that you retire that now it's time for me to hit the gym, right? It's right. You're not going to probably become a new person on retirement. Like you've got, you know, 50, 60, 70 years of being this other person leading up to it. So putting that plan in place in all three of those aspects is just, it makes so much sense rather than sort of, well, when I get there, I'll be a, you know, a fitness athlete, that kind of thing. I think it's just thinking about all of that in advance and, you know, same thing with financial freedom. You're not going to retire and then say, okay, now I invest everything and get, right. You know, financial freedom. It just doesn't work that way. Aside from the fact that time is such a powerful weapon, particularly in investing, but like in any of this, right? Anything you want to achieve, if you give it long enough time horizon, you're going to achieve it. And it, I think it's just, you know, but also the flip is true, is putting it off is going to make you less and less likely to achieve it.
There was an author named Nick Murray who wrote books for financial advisors. And one of the things he always said is something that is not impossible is therefore inevitable. It's just a matter of how long it takes. And I thought that was really great. You know, when it comes to putting money aside, starting early and getting in good habits is so much more important than how much it is when you first start. You know, so we have a lot of clients who will say, look, my son or daughter is 22, they're out of school, they have their first job, will you sit down with them? And the answer is absolutely. We'll build a basic plan for them, help them choose their employee benefits, figure out what has to come next, how much should you put away, are you getting your match, you know, can you afford that rent, are you thinking about a house someday, like what do you want to do? But you can have those conversations with a young adult in ways that they've never had to do this before. They've never had to adult before. In fact, I tell my daughter not to adult because it's a trap, but that's mostly tongue in cheek.
Yeah. There are some traps for sure. In adulting. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I get really, really excited when I get to talk to, you know, especially younger people about, you know, real estate investing and investing, like, again, financial planning, financial freedom of any sort is so important to get started earlier. And so, and it's just, you know, so it's like, take it from an old guy who didn't start early enough and now just feel like I'm playing catch up. Like if I had started it 10 years before I did, I might already be at work optional. Like that would be, and just to be in that position, you know, because I just started earlier, wouldn't have had to invest as much as early, you know, like you said, like just, it's easier to get going sooner. And, but people just don't necessarily realize that.
Well, it is, but it's also not linear. It's exponential.
Right.
And we're going to hit bumps in the road. You know, if you run into a 2008 or 9 market, which is bad for real estate, bad for investments, that doesn't mean it's the end of your journey. It doesn't mean you're an utter failure. It means you have to take certain behaviors and you have to be able to weather that storm. And there's lots of ways to do that. But also things in your life. If you have a divorce is a financial killer. I got divorced on my 28th birthday and had to start over. So, you know, would I be in a better position now if that hadn't happened and everything I had done from 22 to 28 wasn't largely wiped off the map? Yeah. But life doesn't always work that way. It's not,
right.
You know, this isn't a game of perfect. This is a game of have good habits, do the best you can, start where you are. You know, if you've got a listener right now who's 46 who goes, well, I haven't started yet, I guess it's too late, I'm going to do nothing. That's not the answer. That's not what we're suggesting. What we're suggesting is you're better off starting now when you're 46 than waiting 3 years to 49 and then saying, oh, now I really can't get started. Like there's always an excuse.
Yep.
But figure out a way to pay yourself first, to live on 80 or 85% of what you make, you'll never regret that. I mean, you'll wind up building some meaningful wealth and you'll live within your means and you'll avoid adverse debt and you won't lose sleep at night over money. Money is one of the things that is most disruptive to our health anyway. You know, employers report that their employees are most worried about money, not health, not their commute, not even their job security, it's money. And so financial wellness is now a growing thing. I mean, we have a financial wellness program for companies where we meet with their employees and it's changing people's lives in a profound way because it's getting advice they never thought they could get or never thought they could afford or never knew where to find. And if you have a business, if you have business owners here and you've got the ability to help your employees knock out one of their biggest fears, one of the biggest lose sleep at night factors, they'll be better employees. Because they won't be thinking about money. They'll be thinking about their job.
Yeah.
It's that simple. If you're worried about how you're going to make your next mortgage payment, I don't care what project you're working on at work. That's not where you're thinking. It's just not. It can't be.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I mean, it's such an important piece. And, you know, the sooner you realize it, the easier it's going to be to kind of get on track.
Yeah.
So I think really smart. Eric, let me switch gears here so I can ask you the questions I ask every guest.
Your turn to quiz me now?
Yeah, exactly.
Now you're quizzing me? Okay,
you got
I'm ready.
Quiz first. Now it's my turn. Well, you specifically said, you know, what your why is not. So what is your why? What drives you, keeps you, you know, sort of pushing forward to more and more success?
Well, it's funny. I mentioned that my why was a little bit like Holden Caulfield in The Catcher in the Rye. And I firmly believe that. I think my why is that that I can protect people from really, really awful outcomes. And I feel like, I don't feel like an evangelist in any way. And I'm certainly not the smartest human being in the room necessarily, but having done this long enough and caring enough about the folks we represent and about the public in general, and being able to help folks avoid the big mistakes, avoid the iceberg, You know, I just think that my why is we're changing the trajectories of families in lots of ways. Some of it's professional, some of it's personal, some of it's philanthropic. I mean, you know, the charitable work that we're doing as an organization, we have a scholarship at a school locally, at a university locally here, where the vast majority of their students are first generation students. And it's a gap scholarship. So folks who get financial aid, the financial aid offer is 4 years and it's level, but tuition isn't level. So you have kids who could literally drop out of school in their junior or senior year, this close to graduation, possibly with loans, over a few $1,000s. And if we and other organizations can help them stay in school to get their degree, to then have a better job prospect, it can change the trajectory for their family, for generations. Mm-hmm. And so all the things that we're trying to do, the financial just happens to be our skill set. If my skill set was medicine, I'd be doing it medically, but my skill set's financial. So in all the ways that we can be involved, we work with Junior Achievement to do financial literacy stuff for kids. We put out an online financial literacy course that's free for anybody who wants to take it, just to learn some of the basics. White papers that are out there, free resources. Find the person or the firm or the organization or the resource to help push you in the right direction. My why is very simple. I'm trying to protect people from the financial flood. I mean, call me Noah. That was also a Nick Murray thing, is I know the financial storm is coming. I have an ark. Hop on or don't, but if you do, let me tell you how we're going to do this. And again, that's not meant to be a biblical reference, despite the fact it is. It's more or less that we sort of can see the tea leaves. We kind of know what's coming economically. And that's not to say I can tell you which direction the stock market's going. You can't, of course. But I have a pretty good sense of where certain behaviors are going to lead financially. And I'm trying to help people change those behaviors in a positive, productive way without them feeling bullied or bossed. It's a tall order.
Yeah, it is a tall order, but it's so important to, I mean, the idea that of changing lives for generations, it's really true. It's really, It is actually that important. That's not an overstatement. So, very cool. Well, next question for you. Tell us something about yourself that isn't common knowledge. Special skill, a hobby, anything you're comfortable sharing.
Isn't common. Well, I would have said. I will say. My undergraduate education was in late 18th century Romantic poetry. And I studied Coleridge and Wordsworth and Byron and Shelley and Blake and Keats. And I once wrote a paper on Milton in iambic pentameter. True story.
Very good.
Not very many people can say that.
No, no, I'm not sure. I'm sure there aren't a lot. Although one of my good college friends, I'm pretty sure she would have that same background. She was an English major.
Because I'd like to read her iambic pentameter.
Yeah. I was always very, very jealous because she was an English major. I was a science major. I had all these labs and everything like that. And she had like 3 hours of class, 3 days a week or something. Like, it was like always she was in class far less than I was, but
true,
probably
but
far
in fairness,
smarter.
Sometimes we had to read 3 books a week. We were reading three papers a week.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a lot of late nights and a lot of cranking out writing.
Even though
it wasn't a lot of time in class, we weren't using beakers, but we were definitely using our computers.
100%. Yeah. She was definitely putting in the work, but it was just kind of a funny, we would just joke about like, oh yeah, like here's my semester schedule. I'm like, how are you off every Tuesday and Thursday? Like, how did that happen?
You know, I had one semester that I took no classes on Mondays and Fridays, and the only one I took Wednesday was a night class. So my Tuesdays and Thursdays were pretty busy, but I had a 4-day weekend.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good gig. I want that back.
Yeah.
How do I get that now?
You don't know how easy college is until you're out of college in the real world, and you're like, wait a minute, that was way better.
Correct. That's why I think college is something that should be done later in life, actually.
I think
young people probably don't really appreciate it at all. I know I didn't.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I had.
No.
Imagine stretching the college experience out over a period of years that's longer than four. Because why four? Four is arbitrary. It's just the way it's been.
Right.
That's the business model. That doesn't mean it's right.
Right.
Imagine stretching school out over a decade and having 3 months off to go to school every year for a decade or something, some other model where you've got a job, you've got a career, you cover for other people, but you also can then go and delve into the things that you need or want to learn. It's like a little mini sabbatical almost from your work. I just think that there's going to be a new model someday. It may not be that, but it'll be something.
Yeah, that actually would be a really interesting way to structure it. I really do think at this point, like going to college would be a break. Be an easier time than, yeah. It'd be like a vacation. Get to learn for fun.
You know what though? It didn't feel like one then. In fairness, life throws at you what you're capable of handling, and it's a building block. So, you know, at 19, I didn't have the sense that I hope I have now, which is that if I had that opportunity again, I would not only nurture it and cherish it, but I would do some things differently.
Yeah, yeah, you know. Totally. When people hear this and they want to reach out to you, what's the best way?
Our company website is bfgfa.com, and all of our resources, tools, podcasts, and courses are at brotmanmedia.com.
Perfect. Final question, Eric. What piece of advice would you give to someone who wants to get started? A lot of times I'm saying wants to get started in real estate, but take it, honestly, I'll leave it at wants to get started. Take it whatever direction you want. Just, you know, someone hears this, they're excited. What would you tell them as next steps?
Well, number one is don't wait. Don't sit around saying, gosh, I want to, and not doing it. I would say start immediately. Yeah. And the second thing is I would talk to your closest colleagues, friends, family, and find out maybe how they have structured some of their affairs, or more importantly, who they work with. Mm-hmm. Meet with half a dozen financial advisors or firms to sort of figure out where you fit and where you're comfortable. There's a chapter in my book that's basically an interview you can do with financial advisors that basically says, here's the questions to ask and here are the kinds of answers to expect, not because one is better than another, but because you want to really understand what they're talking about, like how are they compensated and who do they work for and how does this impact me and so forth. So it's all there, but it's basically an interview. And if you're not sure who to work with, interview a few folks and just get started. Find a place where you feel comfortable, where you're ideally not being grossly overcharged and not being ignored. I mean, you don't want to be anybody's smallest client, but we all have to start somewhere. Right. So, you know, you find a firm without minimum asset requirements who's going to work with you and grow with you over time. And you build that relationship like anything else and get a second opinion. You know, if someone proposes a financial plan to you, or even if you've paid for and you have a financial plan, have it looked at by somebody else. What are the fleas on that dog? You know, did I miss something? Was this advice truly objective? Because you can't know all of this, and you're entrusting it. Kind of like I can't possibly know what's going on under the hood of my car. It's not what I do. Mm-hmm. And if I go to the dealership and I have my car service and they say you need this, this, and this, I'm in no position to say, no, I don't.
Right.
I'm going to nod, smile, and pay.
Right.
And they know it. And so, you know, understand this a little bit. Read up on it, whether it's Don't Retire, Graduate, or some other resource. Read up on what those things are. There's actually a free resource if you're interested at whatisfp.com, which is a downloadable resource on what financial planning is and what it isn't and what you can expect from the process. And that's a free download for anybody who'd like it.
Awesome. Awesome. We'll put all that in the show notes so they have it too. So, Eric, this was great. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I appreciate it. I appreciate everything that you've shared. I think such a lot of, you know, sort of really important things for people to understand and certainly getting a hold of your book, I think would be a great starting point for people that maybe not even that are just starting, but just for people to have that resource to look to and be able to kind of help get them going. But I completely agree. You have to start. Don't wait. Just, this is so important. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed it. I knew I would. And I wish you continued success with your show.
Appreciate that very much. Folks listening, I know you're going to love this episode and get a lot of value out of what Eric has shared with us. So please like and rate the show. Please like, rate, and review the show so that we can have more great guests like Eric. And thank you all for listening.
Hey there. I am Dr. Jason Ballara, and this is the Know Your Why podcast, where we explore the why behind success Every week, I meet with real estate investors, veterinary entrepreneurs, mindset coaches, authors, and fitness professionals to uncover their why and how it drives them on the winding road to success. What is your why?